What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to just some episodes of Just Another Failure Podcast with a couple of guys failing. Hey, you know, we work with some pretty cool companies, and we've had some fun friends on the show, and what we're liking to do these days is give you guys something back, and we want to be able to hook you guys up with products from rad companies that you guys can go to and get a little discount. We all know in this day and age, it's fun to save a little bit of money, so we've teamed up with a couple companies, and they're sponsoring us with the show, and then we're able to give you guys a promo code. First off, we want to thank London Boat Rentals. London Boat Rentals supplies our studio space and lets us run this awesome office. The guys at London are awesome. If you live in Southern California, head down to Long Beach right next to Ballast Point and grab yourself a Duffy boat for a couple hours. Bring the girlfriend out, bring the family out, bring your dog out. Have some fun, cruise around, safe sailing through the harbor. Also, we work with Muertos Coffee Company out of Winters, California. They are a firefighter-owned and operated coffee brand. Plus, proceeds go back to our first responders and our firefighters nationwide. Plus, they've teamed up with the Fallen Firefighters Foundation, and we are teamed up with the New York Firefighters. It's the official fire coffee for New York Fire Department. The boys at Muertos Coffee will thank you. Use promo code JUSTANOTHERFAILURE at checkout, and you'll receive 15% off. It's amazing coffee, and everything goes to a great cause. We like supporting good causes. Now, I know you guys know I look extra stylish right now.
So sick.
Hey, why do I look so good right now?
Well, that's because we have our buddies over at Heatwave Visuals.
That's right. We actually did a little team up with the Heatwave. You guys probably saw them on episode 29 of Just Another Failure. These guys are rad. California company. They're big in the off-road scene. They make ultra stylish sunglasses, fully customizable. Plus, they make really, really rad lifestyle gear. Head over now. Use promo code FAIL at checkout with Heatwave. 10% off across the entire website. You're not going to regret it. You're going to look really good. You're going to look good. Now, on top of that, we have one of our last sponsors that I'm pretty pumped that we sponsor with. You know, prior to us finding this company, it was kind of barbaric days for me in the bathroom. A little bit of an old soul over here. And, you know, I used to have to manscape with a straight razor. And Wow, were my privates a little bit in some fear every time that I went to the shower. So, no joke. I mean, you use a straight razor in the shower, things get a little scared down
there.
You're
risking it all, pal.
We're risking it all. But the boys at Manscaped found us, and they thought we were pretty funny. They have this awesome skin safe technology, and I've never felt safer in the shower while I'm grooming. Devin, let them know what we're doing with the Manscaped boys so I don't have to lose my nuts anymore.
Yeah, listen up, fellas. We got some big dates upon us. One of the biggest games of the year is February 7th. Yeah, that's right, the Super Bowl.
The what?
The Super Bowl.
I think that's football.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good job, yeah.
All right.
And a week later, we also got a pretty special date too, February 14th. That's Valentine's Day. And our friends at Manscaped are here to make your balls feel super and make sure you're ready for wherever both nights might take you.
I love Super Bowls.
Our partners at Manscaped are here to tell you to join the already 2 million men who trust Manscaped products for their below-the-waist grooming needs.
Firm believer right here. Yep. So is my body.
The best way to get started is with the Manscaped Perfect Package 3.0, full of the best products to keep you looking, smelling, and feeling nice. The Perfect Package 3.0 is led with their revolutionary third-generation lawnmower 3.0 trimmer, which has advanced skin-safe technology and features a cutting-edge ceramic blade to reduce any grooming accidents, so you don't have to be in the barbaric ages like my friend Matt over here. It's also waterproof, which prevents a mess on the bathroom floor and in the sink. And let's be real, we've smelled the worst down there before. That's why I'm thankful for the Crop Preserver and the Crop Reviver. These products keep our boys from sweating, smelling, and sticking. The Perfect Package 3.0 will also come with a pair of Manscaped boxers that'll keep your junk feeling fresh all day. It's time to upgrade those overused pair of boxers to Manscaped's high-performance anti-chafing boxers, easily the comfiest boxers I've ever had. And my girlfriend even loves these boxers and tries to steal them from me all the time, so it's not just for the boys.
Well, you wear your girlfriend's joggers all the time, so it's fine. You know, it's cool. You wear your girlfriend's leggings, so yeah. No wonder why she wants to steal your clothes. Hey. You guys borrow each other's clothes. It's kind of a weird relationship.
Hey, when you're thick like me, dude, you can pull the leggings.
Is that
off.
What you call thick?
And to complete your grooming game with the new Refined Cologne signature scent by Manscaped, with the same signature scent that's in all Manscaped formulas, this cologne's the perfect complement to the collection. So go get 20% off and free shipping with code FAIL at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com and use code FAIL. Tackle your pubes and win the Super Bowl in your pants and be ready for a romantic evening on Valentine's Day with Manscaped. Your balls will thank you.
Hey, we hope you guys enjoy the episode. If you guys are also wondering where we get our awesome flags, we're not Blackbeard up there. We're just a big fan of Blackbeard the Pirate. But we'll see Positive Vibe. You've seen our firefighters. You've seen No Weak Shit. Those are our boys at 30 Seconds Out. They're out of Idaho. They're former operators, veteran brand, and they run some really, really rad stuff with kind of pop culture, skate culture, and the art scene. So head over to 30 Seconds Out. Grab a flag. Grab a hat. Grab something cool. Support a veterans company. But overall, we hope you guys enjoy the episode. Have a good one, guys.
What is going on, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Just Another Failure Podcast with myself, Devin, my buddy, Matt. And with us today, we have our buddy, Ben Hodges with California Cubs. How are you, buddy?
Pretty good. How are you guys?
Awesome, man. Thanks for having us, and thanks for letting us come out, fly with you. That was fun. I've been flying with you on and off for years now, and then we finally got Devin into a airplane and showed him what that was all about, and you took him out, and there's a video coming soon on Devin just loving life and finding out a brand new joy that he's never experienced before in life.
Yeah, so that was pretty neat, dude. I kind of had some fun, I'd say. Yeah,
the pictures turned out pretty good, too.
Just that pure enjoyment face.
So, like, on the vlog, I think, on the vlog, I think I talked about it that I've known Ben since, like, 2008, 2009, when he started California Cubs. I found a video on YouTube back then of, what was it, 1-8 Zulu Quebec?
Was that the first one?
That was it. Yeah. This carbon cub just doing absolutely insane flying. And when I got into aviation, like, bush flying always caught my eye. And then I saw I was in California. I was like, where is this guy doing this in California? So I emailed him, found him, then helped him sell an airplane at one point to one of my customers and ended up flying that and delivered a couple airplanes with you as well. So what? Just a little background on California Cubs, maybe Cub Crafters, kind of when they started, how you kind of got into it, and your background, what you were doing with flying back then.
I actually was introduced to Cub Crafters through Sean Tucker. He was he was the rep for Cub Crafters back in the day, and I started flying with him in 2008.
That's Power Aerobatics, and you'll see him in the Oracle Planet Air shows. That's Sean Tucker.
Yeah. So was flying with him and started selling airplanes for Cub Crafters 2009, and then kind of broke away and just started doing the sales thing. And started with actually flew the first Carbon Cub SS back from Durango, Colorado. 155 Papa Charlie was the proof of concept Carbon Cub, and I was hooked. I didn't really want to have anything to do with Cub flying back in the day. I wanted to fly upside down, 250 knots, 5 feet off the ground. And
which you did. You got your low waiver card.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then that went, that was really fun. And then I got into the Cub stuff and was like, holy cow. So I was flying back from Durango and I had some good tunes going through Monument Valley, window door open, and was like, I didn't know this existed.
Just steady vibing.
Oh, it was so good. And flew down the narrows of Lake Powell and realized that this is what I want to do. And so just that was kind of the start of all of it. Sold 4 airplanes right off the bat and sort of got into the sales thing and really enjoyed it. And it's kind of sharing this experience with new people it was just super fun. So,
yeah, I mean, it's been an awesome airplane. Like, we had similar backgrounds on the styles of flying. We liked acro, bush flying, jets. We've done it all and, like, kind of getting that first diversity of everything that aviation has to offer. But there's something about the backcountry flying that just it's different. There's nothing else like it, and especially with a very light aircraft with way too much horsepower than the airplane should have. It makes this thing a lot of fun to fly.
And that was kind of the cool thing about this side of aviation is it's not only the flying side of it, it's where it can take you. So landing out on the beach in the mountains, camping, the Idaho backcountry, the flying is super fun, but also the places you can go versus normal aviation, you're in the air the entire time. Here, it can take you spots that you just can't get anywhere else. So,
yeah, and that was one thing when I helped Ben sell a Cub to this one client that I knew. He had come up to me one day. He was a owner of a jet, and he operated his own airplane. He was a pilot operator, great guy.
And he was like, hey, Matt, I have this very large piece of property out of state that I think I can land an airplane at. And I was like, okay, cool. What do you... He goes, I heard you're the guy to talk to. I'm like, yeah, there's this airplane out there called the Carbon Cub, and it's awesome. And he told me how much property he had, and it was thousands and thousands of acres. I was like, we could build more than one runway. Like, we can land this thing anywhere. So he was like, I want you to line up a day. And I believe you set it up where we had a Top Cub, a Carbon Cub, and maybe a Husky.
Yeah.
We had all three airplanes lined up for him just to go in and fly and see what each aircraft can do. And at the end of the day, he walked away with a Carbon Cub, which was cool because in turn, he ended up letting me fly that airplane for a while. And I flew all over Idaho, Oregon, Utah. Great plane. And now they've come out with the X Cub, which is funny because Cubs were used to low and slow. Like, we were used to taking off. You fly low. You're only... cards are passing you most of the time. Now the X Cub gets into the game, and we're kind of cruising out there now.
Yeah, and all the FX3 and the X Cub both were kind of developed with kind of cruising in mind as well as low and slow. So cleaning up the ailerons, cleaning up the wing, doing all that attach points, putting fairings on them, allow them to fly fast as well. And so what Devin got to see was how low and fast is versus low and slow, which is pretty bitchy.
Which was, I'm not going to lie to you, we were hauling some ass.
The X-Cub at 150 miles an hour is a pretty awesome platform.
Well, when you're like that close to the ground too, like, I mean, in a car, you're like 150, it feels fast, right? Yeah. But when you're hauling ass going into a mountainside and then you just yank up, you're like, whoa, that came up quick.
Yeah.
Like, that was pretty gnarly.
All the physics come into play. And it was funny because, like, figs. You know, like, Ben, when I flew with him for the first time, when my dad flew with us the first time, and then with Devin, every time you taxi back into the hangar, the people in the airplane are literally just smiling ear to ear, laughing. Like, have you ever had anyone mad? Like, have you ever had anyone bummed?
If there is anybody out there that comes back after doing that without a smile on your face, you might be a psychopath.
And the one thing you want to do is you never want to scare someone in the airplane, right? Mm-hmm. So I kind of knew what I had with you. So we were pretty comfortable there. But I do remember one guy who I was like, he was a crop duster. And I was like, all right, let's go have a nice time in the plane. And he's used to flying low. And he came back and he was like, that scared the shit out of me, and I'm going to buy one. And I was like,
it still worked? So
it worked, kinda. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, that's what we were, like, kind of joking about when we were flying, because you were like, that's basically a test drive in a car is what we kind of did. You took me for a test drive in the plane.
Yeah.
And, I was like, man, that's got to kind of be an easy sell for people if you just go fly them down there on the beach and do what we did. That was... I mean, I don't have the money for one, but I'd buy one. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because a lot of people haven't experienced that. I mean, it's mostly 4,500 to 5,500 feet in somebody's Cessna or go. Even a lot of these guys have go places airplanes with jets and stuff, which is a whole different challenge than freeing your mind and being able to fly down low. Yeah. It is something that you have to take really seriously, and it's something you have a different situational awareness bit of skills that you have to use, but teaching people that is really awesome. So to kind of know what they're doing and look ahead, think ahead, really strap the airplane on and wear it like you would a motorcycle or you've experienced on dirt bikes and mountain bikes, same type of thing, just this is with wings.
Yeah, and we actually talked about that, how it's like the freedom of, I mean, you basically said it was like free ride mountain bike riding just in the air. And when you started like kind of cutting through some of those canyons and stuff, it really was like you're just like kind of going down a trail, but just in the air, which was absolutely insane.
Yeah, you get to create your own lines, right? Yeah. So, and they always, it's just kind of like a mountain bike type setup where the conditions and everything kind of dictate what you can do. The wind conditions, that when we had pretty good conditions before it got a little bit foggy, but that was another thing that we were, just you can use this mountainside and this updraft and the waves are this big, so you can kind of screw around with it like that.
No, it was probably, I still tell people that was probably one of the coolest things I've ever done. So
He's hooked, and you know, it's fun because as like yourself, you're a professional pilot like me, and we've flown different aspects, but
that makes you sound so neat, professional pilot.
People like take us seriously.
This is no amateur stuff, all right?
It's just it's a title. But at the end of the day, like you notice when you fly airplanes and you're flying jets and you have another pilot in the airplane that was a tailwheel pilot or maybe an acro pilot, but more so a bush pilot, like there are skills of understanding what a wing does and how the wing can fly and what the wing's able to do. It's just it's a huge difference, and it brings a whole new atmosphere to the cockpit. And mountain flying, when I was learning, especially going up to Idaho, and I had like yourself and a little bit with Lori at mountain, and I had people tell me what to do and showed me the ways, but I learned a lot of it on my own and reading books and going out trial and error. But mountain flying, especially high altitude airports, landing at Mile High in McCall backcountry, 10,000 foot elevation, what is it, 500 feet usable? And I think it's even cut down to that. And that runway takes people out all the time. But you have an airplane like this that does that job no problem every single time. But you start flying in the backcountry, weather in the summertime changes drastically. And that's a huge thing that we have to take into aspect. And like you said, mountain waves, knowing the leeward side, knowing where the lift's going to come from, where you can get yourself in trouble. Like, there's a lot of knowledge. It looks as fun as this airplane is to fly. It's a very, very knowledgeable way of learning how to operate.
Sure. And the nice thing about learning backcountry off airport type flying is it applies to every other bit of your flying. Mm-hmm. When I flew for the airlines, it was relatively obvious somebody who had even flown a tail dragger or had done sort of backcountry type flying, because you could see that their situational awareness was a lot broader because they have experienced those things and they're able to read wind better. They're able to read kind of the environment that you're in with the airplane. And that's really beneficial to, I think, anybody from a Cessna up to a jet to start to learn that.
And to kind of explain this to everybody else who doesn't fly airplanes, because you guys are throwing around some crazy terms, these planes basically can land in a really short amount of time, and then they can also take off in a really short amount of time, which is really cool, because that's what you're saying, is you can go land these practically anywhere. I mean, it's...
You can do what a helicopter does.
We were making that joke that it's like you almost have a helicopter, but it's in plane form. Where he showed me a video too of it was him, right?
On top of the mountain.
Yeah, where you're like flying into the wind and the thing stops in literally 5 feet.
Yeah.
That was insane. But
and that was the next part I was gonna kind of transition to. Like, aside from the low and slow, but in the mountain flying, we're able to go into places that most people within general aviation just cannot get in and out of. The airplane, on a really good day, if you have like a 10 knot headwind, 20 feet landing?
Yeah. I mean, you can, in a lightweight carbon cub SS, you can routinely land it under 50 feet.
Yeah.
With a 10, 15 knot headwind.
And then take off in almost the same exact plane length. You know, and that's just like, to see what bush flying has become, because you look back to like when Piper did the Super Cub and the PA-18 with 115 horsepower or 150 horsepower, and then like Helio Couriers came out in the 70s or something like that, and that was kind of like the new top of the line. Like, you have a 206 that could take off in a plane length and a half, and now like where we're at now, then you have yourself with Cub Crafters, you have people like Mike with Draco and Scrappy out in Utah that are just building these astronomical airplanes. And kind of prior to those guys up in Idaho at the, Alaska Mayday Flying, there used to be that silver carbon cub, and he had like, what was it, hydraulically actuated flat. He had all sorts of crazy stuff on his airplane, 150 shot of nitrous. Yep. Uh-huh. And yeah.
Because, you know, why wouldn't you run them on nitrous?
Sure.
Well, that's becoming, let's talk about that. Like the stall drag. So I was joking with Ben about this the other day, like, I missed the scene of bush flying because I was doing it right before social media and influencers came out. I was doing it kind of for work and not for fun back then.
Matt's so mad he couldn't be an influencer.
I really am, because I could have had way missed more
his calling.
Yeah, I missed my calling, but it's really unique to actually see how big the community has grown now. And people are more getting into just stall flying and not general aviation. Like, stall flying is becoming its own little niche in aviation. Now we have the stall drags that are just starting. So kind of, what's your take on the stall drags? We can kind of explain the event and what you're doing outside of Reno and how it participates throughout the country.
Sure. I mean, it's I have guys routinely now calling me that have zero interest in doing anything but stall flying, short field takeoff and landing, and backcountries type flying. They have no interest in sort of using their airplane for transportation, and that just wasn't the case 6-7 years ago. I just didn't have that. I was just sort of out there trying to show people what backcountry flying was, and now it's caught on quite a bit. And so through High Sierra Flying, through actually just a lot of people getting into it and realizing that it is the way to access the backcountry, and it's just a super fun way to go fly with your friends. versus just going and getting your $100 hamburger. It's opens up a whole nother realm of aviation. So it's been a pretty cool process over, I don't know, what, 6-7 years. Yeah. It's grown huge, which is good.
And there's large names in the industry. And then the Stoll Drags, that sort of, did that start at the High Sierra Fly-In?
It did. It did. Kevin Quinn started, and the Flying Cowboys started a competition that's essentially a drag race between two aircraft. It really didn't even, they start, there's no classes, there's nothing. You line up on a line and it's ready, go. It depends on where you're located, how long the course is, but call it, I don't know, let's see. I think at High Sierra Fly-In, it was probably a 3/4 mile or something like that. You land beyond the line at the end, stop on heading, turn around, take off, fly back the other direction as fast as you can, land beyond the line and stop. And whoever wins, whoever stops first at beyond the second line, wins a race and moves on to the next bracket.
And now you're what, 5 feet?
Yeah.
If that, off the ground? Like, I mean, your wheels are almost touching.
Yeah, it doesn't, you know, you don't, there's no altitude restrictions, so most people want to accelerate as low as they can, as fast as they can.
Yeah.
That's so nice.
And then, you know, Devin got to experience Reno 2 years ago because of COVID. We had to cancel last year. I heard we're bringing it back possibly this year. Ra-Ra announced that the other day. But the Reno air races have been another huge thing in aviation. They kind of started in, I think, Kansas was initially, and then they came out to Mojave, and they kind of been all over. But they're the, it's kind of a dying breed of what air races is. A lot of people you sell air races to these days, they think Red Bull air race, singular airplane in a course going for fastest time. Reno is more NASCAR style. You have anywhere from 5 to 15 airplanes in the course racing 50 feet off the ground and going 500 knots in the unlimited class, 500 miles per hour in the unlimited class. And it's the fastest form of racing out there, but they introduced the Stoll Drag. So Devin got to go up to that. And, you know, over the years we've had tragedies, plane crashes. It's part of the sport. It's, you know, and we mourn and we respect the ones that fell during the events. But, I mean, your aspect on that, that's kind of where you kind of saw Stoll and like the big tire airplanes and Tundra tires and stuff. And then you saw Ben with Cub Crafters up there.
Yeah.
And
yeah, that was actually the first time that we met you was up there. But yeah, I mean, coming from like me not having any knowledge of flying in general, like he took me out to the Reno air races and he was trying to explain it to me. And I was like, okay, like, NASCAR in the air, sure. Yeah. Right, like, doesn't even make sense. And then we got there and I was like, whoa, like, this is gnarly. These guys are hauling ass not very far off the ground and they're really close together. And then the Stoll races as well was like, that was like, whoa, dude, planes can do that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, planes can just land that quick, turn around and take off again. I was like, that's not, because I'm used to like commercial flying, right? Sure. Where you got a massive runway and those dudes are slapping the deck and those things. But yep. But yeah, no, that was like absolutely insane and eye-opening to see that planes can do that. I was absolutely shocked with that.
And Stoll Drag was relatively, was that the first year or the second year?
I think it was the first.
First year, and yeah. It was interesting because the main races, the unlimited races and all those classes, they're super popular, but the Stoll Drags actually got the biggest crowd interaction because it's kind of right there in front of you.
Yeah.
And so, and you start, you pick your favorite racer and then, and you're able to watch them through the brackets. And it was, they used it kind of as a demonstration and to see what the reaction would be from putting it kind of right in front of a crowd. And it was a really positive reaction.
Dude, I feel like you could get that into like that's almost like horse racing. Yeah. And like there's some degenerates out there. Oh, yeah. That would be just throwing gambling bets. Oh, yeah. Down on bracket racing.
Oh, absolutely.
Like you could have like, we could have some actually cut this off. We're starting our own
series.
Our own betting series here.
But what's that's growing now, right? Because yep. You have High Sierra, you have Reno, and then there's another couple more, right?
Yeah, I think the goal of it is to do it, just to do it at Oshkosh and get it into get it as a more mainstream event, I think is what the goal is.
It's funny because like 2008-09 when I first met you and got into this, like coming from ranch land, stuff like that, I always had these ideas in the back of my head, like, you know, like we could create this whole like Stoll event where like we get private owners of ranches and we have different courses set up on different ranches where pilots can go and you're landing and doing different things at different ranches. And like it could really be a cool event and you could almost like set it up like spectators at ranches, but really just do it like a live TV event and you're seeing airplanes race ranch to ranch, and you have maybe like an uphill runway at one, you have, you know, a water assisted landing out, like the whole facets that this thing is possible. Like, if you got the right funding behind it, like this could turn into like what the new Reno present day kind of race thing is and create a huge audience. It has that potential.
And there's a couple of guys actually in California that have set up some of those race courses with six or seven runways within call it 50 acres or something along that, just a small area, and sort of started to do time trials and stuff on and see how it would go. Uphill runways across, obviously the wind has a lot to play with it, and it's super fun.
Yeah, I mean, it's really cool what you're able to do with this style of aviation and flying. But I mean, aside from that, like, you've gotten into so many different aspects of motorsports, and your kind of latest venture, what, almost a decade, your AMA kind of racing.
Yeah, now, right? So I started racing motorcycles. I actually started racing when I was in my senior year of high school. I built a bike from my buddy's crash parts and went out to Willow Springs, got my license and raced novice, and had spent every dime that I had, borrowed buddy's trucks to get out there. That obviously wasn't going to be long-term. You crash and then you can't put your bike back together. I was playing baseball at the time and had to take that seriously. But then 10 years later, my buddy Roger said, you got to come out, get a bike. I bought a KTM RC8 and went out to Buttonwillow Raceway and started that whole journey. And I picked it up again pretty quickly. So I had to go race because that's what it's about.
Yeah.
And so I got in and started racing again. And I think it's been 5 straight years or something along those lines. And it's awesome. I mean, motorcycle racing is the ultimate. People kind of think you're crazy, but in reality, the precision that you have to ride at that level is just, it's bitching. And the challenge is there. It's really, really fun.
Dude, those things are literally rocket ships too. Those things, I mean, I come from a dirt bike background, and I think superbike dudes are absolute nutbags.
We think that's the same about you guys.
It's they're like, oh, you jump.
It's always like, funny, like, how action sports, like, do that across the line. Like, you come from wakeboarding into moto, and moto guys look at wakeboards like, dude, you guys are nuts. Like, you guys fall, and it hurts, and you're breaking your legs. And, like, you look at moto guys just flying 40 feet through the air, and you're like, dude, you guys are, like, everyone just kind of has their own little equal respect for each other in the industry.
I don't know, like, something about the asphalt and going that fast is way too scary for me.
I think it's one of the coolest things about action sports is that everybody understands how difficult it is to perform at that level. Yeah. So when they see it, they have that appreciation, which is that awe factor, which is really cool. So And road racing is interesting because it is like absolute precision at super high speed. So
it's almost like an art form. It really is. It's crazy watching, like, especially if you slow it down and you see, like, people are sliding into corners where at full speed you don't see stuff like that. And it literally is. It turns into like art in motion when you're watching it. And I'm just the superbike stuff, it scares me because that's too fast for me. Too fast.
Yeah, and if you're gonna push the limits, you end up crashing, right?
Matt's trying to get me to do this, by the way.
Yeah,
let's go.
Yeah, I think we all should go.
I have two bikes and an extra set of leathers.
Yeah, let's go. Oh, like, we're gonna make this happen. We're gonna go meet at the track. You flew. Now you're gonna go race super bikes. But I mean, as far as that goes, you're kind of getting the best both worlds in your life. You know, we've talked about like the professional side of flying, and you know, the wears and tears on your body and lifestyle, and you've come from like being a competitive aerobatic pilot, low level waiver, and an instructor aerobatic pilot, bush flying. So you kind of took, because you're not really flying acro right now.
No, not really.
But you kind of took the acro side and put that like in super bikes, where you have that precision, high speed, really adrenaline rush of that. And then you now have the bush flying. So you're like, you're still getting the best of both worlds out of this whole situation.
And I've always realized that at some point I've competed at something. And that's always, I just kind of a couple years ago realized that I wanted to continue that. And you're right, with bush flying and that kind of stuff, you're not, there is no competition about it. You stay within yourself. You push your limits in a very safe way, which is good. But in acro flying, you're able to push the limits up at altitude, and that was a really fun experience. But it gets to it ran its course, and then getting back into motorcycle racing is some way to really enjoy competitive stuff and do it at a reasonable price.
It kind of fills the void a little bit of yeah. that craziness that you need.
Exactly.
I think at some point I got to go take him up like in the pits or something yeah. like that and just go tumble and have well, some so, fun with him.
Dude, I don't know. We were kind of talking about this earlier too. Like that has to be one of the gnarliest feelings, right? It just grabbing an airplane and just basically falling out of the sky. A controlled fall, but yeah. still falling out of the sky.
And the crazy part about aerobatics is like the physiological shape that you have to be in is like your physique has to be awesome because you're going through negative and positive G's when you're doing like competition style aerobatics. When you tumble an airplane, you're doing negative and positive G's like in the same motion. And so like yeah. you're going from like breathing really heavy to like feeling like your eyeballs are going to pop out of your head.
And the
over and over.
Yeah. And so when you watch it and you can watch really hardcore aerobatics and be like, wow, that looks intense. But until you feel it, it is the most uncomfortable feeling you can have. It's just that negative G's are intense and positive is even, I mean, your body's going through things it just wasn't designed to do, which getting yourself to just accept that fact is an interesting masochistic deal when you're pushing 6 negative G's and your head is going to explode and your seatbelt is literally holding 2,000 pounds of body weight. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah. I think you just pretty much sold everybody on doing aerobatic flying.
Like if you're, what do they always say? Like an acro, like in a high acro airplane, like if you're uncomfortable, you're set right. Because yeah. like the seatbelt's literally like they're dirt bike tie downs, like ratchet yeah. style tie downs, and you're ratcheting yourself into yeah. your seat.
Yeah. And you still feel like it's not tight enough. Yeah. Like you ratchet it until you almost can't feel your legs. And then you're like, go one more click.
It's yeah. like it's like when you get on the roller coaster and yep. you go a little too tight and you're like, I can't breathe.
Yep.
I can't breathe.
That's exactly right. where you need to be. And that's where you're going to get
And that's comfortable, huh? Sweet. Yeah.
But one of the coolest feelings in the world is being able to go up and really try anything in an airplane and be that comfortable in an airplane with your machine and your abilities to start making freestyle maneuvers up, right? Yeah. So like I created something called the spiraling tower. People have used that term before, but it's where essentially you pull on a vertical line, roll left a quarter turn, and then go right with right forward stick, right forward. You just go all the
way
into
the corner.
Yeah, so you tumble all the way to the top until you end up in an inverted flat spin. And it's really cool to be able to go try those things. And as a passenger, the first time we go do this, you will be
I like how he says yeah we go do this
it's you almost can't you don't have the it's sensory overload and you're a little bit disoriented because you're like where's the horizon so yeah.
So you're entering like a Lomshavak at the top and like uh-huh. Lomshavak into an inverted flat spin.
Yeah, you kind of shoulder roll tumble on okay. the top and then you end up doing like a pirouette at the very top inverted and then it flips to an inverted flat spin and then you flip it to an upright flat. Yeah, it's a lot. we'll show a video.
I was trying to like go put my head through the yeah. motions, but yeah, yeah, we'll attach a video to this. Yes. I'm sure we have some footage somewhere.
I like
of this.
Matt's version. He looked like Harry Potter yeah. shaking a wand around.
I'm like kind of like getting my head around like his control inputs.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. But really kind of like bush flying. Being able to strap on an airplane and do just whatever you want in it and have that intimate knowledge and precision is just a blast.
It's gnarly is yeah. what it is. But I mean, I don't really listen to Matt very well, but were you telling me that like he
thanks.
I don't really care to listen to him.
That's what makes this relationship work in yeah. the podcast. You know, our partnership on the business really worked because he never listens to me.
He talks a lot. It just goes in one ear, out the other. But were you saying that he actually kind of taught you how to fly?
Yeah, like the bush side.
Yeah.
Yeah, like he really introduced me to the bush side of flying. Like that's... I mean, I had some stuff in like J3 Cubs and some Super Cubs and played around at the local airport and landed at Fraser Lake and, you know, easy stuff. And then like Ben was the one that showed me how to put an airplane in 50 feet okay. and water ski and go down and use water assisted. Now that's a whole nother thing we've never really talked about. We haven't showed Devin water skiing or water assisted, but like water assisted, what's the best way to walk through that? I mean, you're using the friction of the water to slow your aircraft down to get on something very short.
Sure. And everybody, I mean, somebody that has boated or water skied or wakeboarded, you know that there's that you can skim on top of the water. And the water assist versus water ski is two different things. Water ski is just kind of for show. You're going plenty fast and you're skiing on the water. And then water.
That's where your wheels are.
So actually, I was going to say, these are just normal wheels.
Yeah, you're not on floats.
Basically skimming across the water.
Yeah,
And then, you got to break it down for the dummy over here. No worries.
And then water assist, one, is the the easiest way to perfectly screw up your airplane, if you screw it up. But it is essentially being able to fly below stall speed because the water is taking some of the weight off the wing, essentially. So you can fly a few miles an hour below stall speed so you can get into spots that you wouldn't typically be able to land and stop in. You're already on the water, skiing onto this gravel bar, and you're able to, it's about 15 to 20% shorter to use water getting into a gravel bar than landing and stopping on that.
Then you could use water to take off as well. Mm-hmm. You can do a water assisted takeoff as well.
Wait, what?
Yeah. So you can, if you have a piece of land and there's water right there,
you can just basically,
you can just go, you could transition from land to water and use the water to accelerate to before you take off.
Dude, that's kind of gnarly.
You really have to know your airplane super well. And it's a whole different ball game when it comes to trying to utilize water to get in and out of a spot. But like Matt said, is you can, if you have a 50-foot gravel bar and you're loaded and the atmospheric conditions require 70 feet, as long as you're able to get to what you call above your penetration speed so you don't sink in the water, then you can ski off of the gravel bar.
Now, you guys could go on YouTube and type in water-assisted landings, water skiing. You could see them, and you could see the fail side. Like, sometimes people misjudge where, because you're judging also where the shallow of the water starts and the land starts, and sometimes there's a shelf. So you'll see people chop power early, and all of a sudden, like, their airplane dives and, like, comes over the top of the airplane, and there's all sorts of crazy stuff that's happened, and
you get the old glug 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 underwater there.
Yep.
No, I mean the pioneering of bushwhack, it came out of Alaska, kind of, right? Like that's kind of the pioneer. That's the hometown. That's where this started at.
Yeah, I think it started where that was the only. I mean, there's a couple ways to look at it. In Alaska, there's only one way to get in and out of a lot of these towns is by air. And then if you go to one step further into backcountry off airport is. You're able to get into hunting grounds and carry people, hunters in, and drop them off at these sort of unimproved strips that we have.
And I mean, Alaska kind of really coined the term one-way airports, which that kind of started out of Alaska. And that means there's only one way in and one way out. So like the way you land, is you're taking off that direction that you just landed. So sometimes you're going into something, there's a massive cliff right in front of you, and you don't have two ways of a runway. It's just one way in, one way out. And that's where that stuff got really dangerous. And that's where people started kind of clipping themselves. But they were like really pushing the envelope to see what an aircraft could do.
Sure, absolutely. And for example, if you're going to take off and land on a steep slope, you can actually land a steep slope better with a tailwind and take off better with a headwind. So that's a one way out, one way in, one way out type deal as well.
So, I mean, I think I have to ask, have you had a gnarly, like, close encounters with, you know, maybe a sketchy area taken off or landing? Well, I mean, and it could be with water, too, because you were kind of telling me it's hard to kind of judge where you're at landing on water sometimes.
Glassy water.
Oh, glassy water. Okay.
Glassy water sucks.
Because you kind of can't tell, like,
your depth perception.
I've actually only had sketchy situations when I'm instructing. To be totally honest, when I'm going back and flying, I tend to keep it pretty within the limits of the aircraft. But there's a couple things you can't do from the backseat of a Cub. Is one, you can't get somebody off the brakes, and two, you can't see over the nose. So people do some interesting things so that you have to fix from the backseat of the airplane. But that's pretty much the. Besides that, flying from the front seat is we don't really put ourselves in a lot of sketchy situations.
I'm sure you don't.
It looks really sketchy, but it's not.
Totally in control.
Yeah, exactly.
Backseat flying, I actually started having way more fun with. Because, I mean, I originally, my first Cub was a J3. And 65 horse hand prop, you have to fly that airplane from the back.
Yep.
Especially someone my size. You're not sitting up front. So single pilot in this airplane, you fly it from the back. And you kind of get used to it flying with the door open. And I remember I was teaching people and like the Carbon Cub and the Huskies and stuff, people saw that I was flying with you or out in Idaho, and they're like, hey, can you help me? Like, yeah, I'll come out and we'll go land on some comfortable ranches. And I remember one day I was up at my buddy's ranch in Napa, and he built this cool runway, and I called him. He's like, yeah, just stay off the middle. It's a little wet in the middle. I was like, all right, cool. So I was doing some landings. The guy's like, can you land this from the back? I was like, yeah, all day. Like, it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
And we came in, and I definitely found the middle of the runway. I was coming down, like, kind of looking at it, and I touched down, and then I wheel landed it from the back, which that was my first time ever wheel landing from the back, and that was kind of a different scenario. Sure. And a different take on it. But it's really easy. It kind of correlates back and forth. Now, some airplanes, like you get into the warbirds and stuff, it's a totally different animal flying that thing from the back seat. You can't see anything. Like,
sure.
Ground, landing, you're in the blind on half that stuff. But we'll talk a little bit about, tailwheel versus tricycle. We can kind of break that down. And now, what was Cub Crafter's thought on introducing a tricycle gear Cub to the market?
Well, the interesting thing, and I was going to bring that up in instructing, is once we came out with the NX Cub, it made my life a whole lot easier. Because if somebody's on the brakes in the front seat, it doesn't really matter. And it's just a significantly easier airplane to land, just because of the configuration. And the Jim Richman, the owner of Cub Crafters, I remember him talking about producing a nose wheel Cub for as long as I've known him. And it's been something that essentially he's probably wanted to bring to the masses, because backcountry flying and tailwheel flying, there's only about 17% of the pilot population that has their tailwheel endorsement and is essentially rated to fly a tailwheel aircraft. And so that really narrows the market of who can fly backcountry and fly in our airplanes. So coming out with the NX Cub was a big step, and it was something that allowed all pilots that have a single engine land endorsement or pilot's license can fly the airplane.
Now, you're not doing the light sport, right, with the X Cub. That's not qualifying anymore.
Correct.
Because you're over your 100 horsepower, and you're okay. So that's just you have to have a full private pilot's license to fly
the X
Cubs. For Devin and other people that don't fly, so you have two types of aircrafts. You have your tricycle configuration, which most of you guys probably see at your airports. You have a nose wheel and then two mains underneath the center of the airplane. A tail wheel is kind of what we began with in flying. They were actually called tail draggers in the beginning, because when we first started making airplanes, there wasn't actually a wheel back there. It was a skid, and there was also no brakes on the airplane. You used to just land in an open field no matter what direction the wind was coming. And when you landed, you just dragged your skid in the back into the dirt, and that's how you stopped. And so,
hence the name tail dragger. Yeah. Wow.
That's a little history for you guys. And so tailwheel was kind of the only way of flying until the 1940s, 50s?
Probably something around
somewhere
there.
Right around there. And then the tricycle gear came out, and it's a much safer form of flying a tricycle compared to a tailwheel. Tailwheels scare most pilots in today's day and age. They don't want to learn because there's things called ground looping and everything, and they're hard to control on the ground. They fly the same in the air, but once you're on the ground, it's a whole different animal that you're actually dealing with. And so, like he said, the very slim market in today's day and age actually knows how to fly a tailwheel aircraft. And so that's cool that they brought something to allow more people to get into the bush with a high-performance airplane and not just go get in the Baja kit on their 182.
Yeah, exactly. And it was the NX Cub is a convertible gear setup. So you can, in that same aircraft, you can put it in the tailwheel configuration.
Just hit the switch, new wheels
boom,
come out.
Yeah. Done. Yes, yeah. And then wait 2.5 hours, go grab a coffee, and your mechanics can get it done.
It's a long switch, but yeah.
But yeah, it was a way to bring that all to, essentially bring it to more of the population. And that was, I think, the thought behind it.
Yeah, because, I was talking to someone the other day, and we were talking about Cub Crafters. I've been a big advocate of you guys forever, and I've flown the Malls and the Huskies and the Helio Couriers and whatnot. But people are always like, but you're paying $300,000 for a Cub. And then I kind of put it back in retrospect for them, because I was like, well, go over to Cessna and tell me how much a brand new 172 is. And sure, it's technically a four-place airplane compared to a Cub being a two-place airplane. But if you load down a 172, it's really only a two-place airplane at the end of the day, and you're $500,000 for a brand new 172 G1000 and all the bells and whistles. I mean, you're really getting the same aspect, but with a Cub, you're now getting something that's way more versatile. And like you talked about the other day, 80% of plane owners out there, they're not really mission oriented in their GA airplane. They're more, let me go fly around the pattern. If I live in California, let's go over the ocean. And a lot of the times they're just flying with one or one extra person or by themselves. It's not like they're getting four people every day and getting in their airplane and going flying.
Yeah, it is. It's interesting because a lot of the guys we sell airplanes to are, this is a better aircraft for them. For, I mean, one, it does local flying pretty great. And a guy with a Mooney who's out just beating out the traffic pattern in his Mooney, it was really not designed for that. And so it's a lot of people are seeing the light when it comes to enjoying their aircraft and flying the low and slow and enjoying, and tandem configuration front and back seating is actually really, the visibility is incredible. It's a lot nicer flying experience to just get up in the air.
Yeah, it's more scenic. And then with these, we could fly with the door open. Yep. We could fly with the windows open. Yeah. And I mean, the X-Cub now, it's probably a little bit more difficult at 150 miles an hour across the ground. The guy in the back's going to be definitely grabbing a little bit more drag back there. But
the nice thing about the X-Cub, you can slow it down. I mean, with Devin, we pop the window and the door open. It flies low and slow great as well. So it kind of does the whole spectrum. Yeah,
the wind wasn't even bad back there when we were cruising. And that was actually like, that was super cool too. I mean, obviously flying with the door open is something you don't really... Not many people get to experience that, right? Yeah. I mean, other than some, like we were talking about, like being in a helicopter is probably the closest thing. But sure. You don't get to sit in an airplane with the door wide open, being able to just be like, oh, that's the ocean down there.
And that's the first reaction.
Touch the sand when we're landing now. That's cool.
You can smell the ocean. You can feel the air. It's really cool interaction that you have once you open up the window and the door. It's pretty bitching.
And he was talking about that. Like, if anyone's been to Disneyland, Disney World, they have a ride called California Adventure, which I think is now called Soaring Around the World, but it puts you in a hang glider and it puts you over very scenic places. Now, while you're on the ride, this was Devin's biggest anti-feedback from flying with Ben, is they put scents in the air. And so, like, when you're down low, you smell the ocean, you smell the oranges. And Devin just wasn't excited that he didn't get all the scents. So we're going to have to kind of work in a little scent spray system, kind of spray some stuff in the air. But, I mean, you're actually getting the real smell when you're out there. And so...
Was not impressed with the scents, just saying. I mean, you guys could definitely work on that.
One of my favorite things with the Cub is always, like, when you're flying air traffic control, which you try not to talk to too much anymore when you're flying low and slow. But I remember when I was flying his Cub up to Oregon with him, he initially told me, he's like, hey, fly the Cub to the ranch. I'll bring the Citation up, pick you up and come back. And then he called me and was like, hey, I'm going with you. And I was like, you know how long this is going to take, right? Like, this is a 2-day journey for us going up there. This isn't just jumping up to the Eastern Oregon. He's like, oh no, I'm well aware. And like the first day was summertime and we got to Redding. He was like, I'm done. I'm like, dude, I still have like another 6 hours ahead of me. Like, let's get over Shasta and keep going. But it's funny because like air traffic control, we'd be like going up by Shasta. And Shasta is what, 10,000, 12,000 feet, something like that?
I think it's 14, isn't it?
Yeah, 14. Yeah. And we're down at like just 500 feet over the top of the mountains. And I remember at one point Shasta's like, do you know there's a giant mountain? I was like, yeah, I see the volcano. And then a lot of times they'll lose service. But what was cool?
Looking right at the ground here.
I'm staring at it. But the best part about that is like where I used to live on hot summer days is just open your door and just let the breeze fly in.
Yep.
And like, because are you guys doing air? Is there like a ram air vent or there's no AC, obviously.
There's no AC, but we have vents on the skylight. Yep.
That's right. Yeah. I remember those. Oh yeah. They flip up.
Yep.
Yeah. That's right. I do remember those now. So it's been a little while since I've been in the Cubs, but I'm starting to fly them again and get refamiliarized with the airplane. They're a ton of fun to fly. And so factories in Yakima, that's where he kind of found it out. Now, when did he start Cub Crafters? What year did Cub Crafters become a brand?
Cub Crafters was started in the early 80s as a Super Cub and aircraft rebuild factory. And then, so they did that until, I believe they built they started to build Super Cub, essentially Top Cubs, from spare and surplus parts that they had sourced from a couple of vendors. Then that moved into their own type certificated own aircraft called the Top Cub, which then they also started to build a light sport called the Sport Cub, 100 horsepower Cub in the light sport category. And from the Sport Cub developed the Carbon Cub around 2009, 2010. The Carbon Cub was essentially a beefed up Sport Cub with 180 horsepower. And then from there, it's gone into, we now do builder assist program, which we call the FX program. And you can get an FX2, FX3, different engine platforms, all in the Cub configuration. And then obviously came out with the X Cub and the NX Cub. So just it's developed, and Cub Crafters has always been super good about pushing the limits of of what they can fit in the Cub type platform.
Well, and it's kind of cool too, when we were checking out the plane. I mean, they're somewhat fully customizable. I mean, inside you can kind of pick what you want. You know, obviously you can go full high end and everything. It's like a rocket ship in there. It looks really, the thing was nice.
So the XGI, we have different interior options, different panel options, so different instrumentation. You can get on some of the aircraft, you can get different fuel tank options. And then throughout the different, if you get a different platform, so an FX3 versus a Carbon Cub SS versus an X Cub, they're all different engine platforms. So pretty much we cover the entire spectrum of the Cub type airplane.
Yeah, I mean, it's awesome. And then you also offer a full home build kit now.
Yep. Yeah.
So you guys can go online and do your little price sheet and get everything. And it, you get a couple crates sent to you. And you can buy it in pieces because you can do a wing kit, a fuselage kit, and then a
it's basically a big Lego set.
It is. Yeah. It's like an adult Lego set. It's perfect. And when you end up with the airplane, you go fly it.
And yeah, and it takes about, I mean, like, 1,200 hours is
about that. If somebody was going to take it from start to finish, it's about 1,200 hours.
Really? That's how long they take?
Uh-huh.
But yeah, you just get a bunch of parts.
I mean, I guess it is an airplane, so it's like they don't just snap together real quick, huh?
We've had guys do them really in a short period of time. I think it was 82 days somebody built a kit from when it showed up.
They were
he devoted his entire existence to that, and that's all he did. And he had built a couple kits before, so typically it takes you, if you're after it, about a year.
Wow.
But it's a little bit more affordable to kind of get in it over time because you can buy sections of the airplane at a time and complete a section, get another section, complete a section, get another. You don't have to buy the entire kit at once. So that's kind of a nice side of it. And then there's a grass strip at Yakima, right? At the factory?
There isn't at this point, but there's a bunch of grass strips that are just outside of the Valley.
Yeah.
I think that that you go and do demo flights. That there's actually some really cool gravel bars on the Yakima River also.
Oh, I haven't done those ones.
Where's Yakima?
Washington.
It's central Washington. It's about 2 hours east of Seattle.
What's the gorge called that you go up there? There's a name for that gorge. The
Columbia Gorge?
Yeah, I think it's the Columbia Gorge. Yeah. Yeah, it's really pretty country up there. Absolutely. It's really cool. And then, do you fly with Hannah ever?
I haven't.
He's the scout guy up in Idaho, and he's flying the other stuff, but he's got a pretty cool setup up there in Idaho. And I know you've done a good amount of time in Alaska, Idaho, and you're kind of going all, what's your region now? Because you were initially kind of California, and now you've taken over Nevada and Arizona?
So it's just California and Nevada is my exclusive Cub Crafters region. So all new aircraft in that region that's what I represent.
Okay. And then you were kind of the original West Coast dealer.
Yep. Yeah, I think.
Or Sean.
Yeah. So that was all a rep system prior. And now it's a dealer network. And Chip Allen from Georgia, him and I were the first two that signed up as dealers. And then it's gone from there. I think there's about six of us now.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
That ain't bad at all. But yeah, I mean, it's fun. It's really diverse. And you're getting customers like crazy right now.
Yeah, it's the
business is booming.
It's been pretty good. I mean, COVID's been interesting, but people are still out trying to have a good time. It's interesting because it's mirrored sort of the recreational world. Everyone's sort of looking for a way to get away from people and get out and do fun stuff. So for aviation, it's been the people have veered towards backcountry style flying, and we've had a lot of interest in the new platform with the NX Cub and just a lot of interest in general because people want to make their dreams happen now rather than planning 10 years down the line.
So how far can you go? I mean, I don't know what tank size is and obviously what how they burn gas as well. How far can you go in one of those in like a single session?
It's about 600 to 800 miles, depending on your wind, depending on what power settings you use and that kind of stuff. So, and obviously what size tanks that you have, but you can go, you can call it about 600 miles.
Not bad.
Yeah. The X Cub, I've done Yakima. I run mine a little bit harder 'cause I'm trying to get somewhere, and I'm about 500 miles.
Not bad.
And you guys have introduced an autopilot platform, which is nice.
Which is great.
And that
he put the thing on autopilot the whole time when we were flying. Yeah. He didn't even fly it. He was lying.
I just let it do it. Yeah, I was like, watch the thing go.
Yeah, yep. She just programmed in all the canyons and maneuvers and actually smart turns everything.
He was doing emails and stuff up there. He's a liar. Don't let this guy fool you. He's not even a pilot, I don't think.
When did you guys introduce the autopilot? That's been 5 years now?
2015 okay. was the Six. Garmin G3X Touch with the autopilot, which has been really, Aaron, why would you have a Cub with an autopilot when it actually comes in really, really useful when you're going on long cross-country flights and flying in the LA area, San Francisco area, it's really nice to have that thing. You have everything. It follows your magenta line that you put into the GPS and stays at that altitude. You can look for traffic and allows some workload management.
Children of the magenta. But yeah, it's a great video that they show you in every training because I don't think you've ever seen it before.
I was going to say, does the magenta line have a meaning there?
There's a video from, 1985 probably at American Airlines training, when GPS was getting implemented and this guy's basically saying how pilots are relying too much on automation, only following the magenta line and not thinking outside the box anymore. And there's this single platform of people not being able to be multifaceted in aircraft anymore, which sadly it's become true. I mean, airplanes have become so automated and stuff that you kind of lose a cognitive of surroundings, what's happening around you. And that's where this style of flying, you can't lose that. I mean, as much as you can follow the magenta line and you can go and fly through LAX airspace on autopilot that allows you to, especially single pilots, high busy airspace, allows you to be more cognitive in those environments and be more looking outside and not focusing on holding altitude, holding heading when you're on very strict situations in high level airspace.
Yeah. So, utilizing automation to increase your situational awareness rather than make it sort of narrow focused.
So, I mean, being able to land these things in wherever you want, pretty much, what's been one of the coolest places you've been able to go? What's been one of your favorite things you've been able to take these airplanes in?
I really enjoy, a couple of spots probably. Just locally here, the flying that we have is incredible. So landing in the dunes and on the beach is unbelievable. The mountaintops that we have here are pretty cool. But I got to say, being in the Idaho backcountry on Mile High was a pretty awesome experience.
One of my favorites.
Yeah, just the views from there are insane. And doing that with the group that we did recently with a really good friend of mine, the Texas dealer Mike Sasser, Jim Richmond, the owner of Cub Crafters, and Brad Doms, the VP of sales there, for just have that group that kind of have is integral in the aircraft and the sales and the creation of all of that, having them all there at that point was just pretty bitching.
So Mile High for you, it's 10,000 feet elevation.
It's 6,000.
Oh, that's right. It's 6,000.
I love Matt's numbers.
Well, he's no, because that country's high. There's
I think
a lot
it's about 8,000 feet. I no, think it's 12, Matt. No, oh, okay.
That country's high. And it's Frank's Church Wilderness and No Return is where that runway's located in central Idaho. But yeah, 6,000 feet, and it's, it's an uphill, pretty steep. I think your runway here is tougher than Mile High.
Yeah, that one's it's a 25-degree incline side of a mountain that wasn't really designed to land an airplane on. But Mile High, I think, is probably 15 or 16% gradient at that high altitude. It's good to get in.
I know. I haven't been into Mile High since 2010 or 11, so it's been years, but have they made it easier to find? Because back then, you weren't able to put in a GPS because it's a forestry. Technically an emergency forestry use runway is what it's labeled as on charts.
Couldn't follow the magenta line. Yeah, there.
You can't. You kind of have to know the region to actually find the runway. And there's a kind of a distinctive tree at the top, too, that kind of marks it pretty well. But so it's still kind of, you got to go with someone that knows where Mile High
is. It's really hard to find because you can't see it from if you're flying down the valley, it's on the other side of the mountain.
Yeah.
So, it's not, I wouldn't have been able to find it.
I mean, that, like you said, Idaho is probably Arizona was fun. Utah was pretty unique.
Yeah.
But Idaho, it really pushed a lot of my learning capabilities of flying airplanes, Wilson's Bar, Cabin Creek, runways that are down at the bottom of these gorges that Wilson's Bar, you have to follow the river in when you're going in. So you overfly the airport one way and kind of see if there's anyone there. And then you follow this in. And then I think it's turn three. That's when you're committing to land the airplane. If you're not committing, you've got to start going out and finding an exit out of the valley. But you're pretty much just going. And all of a sudden you're all right, I'm committed. And then you come in and you land. And for a while, there was a crash 210 at the end of that runway that used to sit upside down. I think it was a forestry one out there, actually, that crashed at the end of the runway one day out there.
Just to let you know, like, hey, if you suck, this is what happens.
Yep, fly good, don't suck.
Yeah, that's our new t-shirt. Yeah, new collab with Ben. We're coming out with fly good, don't suck.
Fly good, don't suck.
Yeah, like, what was the skydiving one? If you fail often in life, skydiving's not for you.
Yeah.
I mean, that actually kind of goes into perfect for what we do. Like, yeah. I mean, just being just another failure. I hope you don't have like some horrible fail stories being a pilot and flying, but you know, you never know.
You don't have a lot of them if you do, right?
Yeah, right. So
we all talk about you in past tense.
Yeah, sorry.
Our laws are written in blood, unfortunately.
Yeah, but like, I mean, what has been, I mean, do you have any failure side of things, whether it was learning to fly, whether it be with the business, what?
Building a business, hardships or something that you had to overcome.
The most interesting thing has been the career and realizing that it does. I've been furloughed 3 times from the airlines. So, I never sort of thought that that aircraft sales was going to be my full-time all-in gig. But over the years, it's just been the thing that I've been the best at and that has served me well and been the most consistent thing. So, kind of those types of just taking the hits of the airline industry where you're just a number. And when your number's up, they're like, well, see you later.
Have a good one.
Yep. That was an interesting, that's been, the career has been awesome, but also has its shortcomings.
Yeah. I mean, that's anything for us in aviation. Like aviation itself can be a giant failure of a commitment choice for a career. Oh, yeah. Like, I mean, you learn the hard way. You really do. And I mean, a lot of us on social media, some are more popular than others. Like, you'll post the glamour, you'll post the fun. And we talked about this the other day. Like, my job, yeah, sure, I went around the world. But there's a certain point, too, like, we do end up finding that niche market where we know we're supposed to be. And I mean, I haven't leaked it on social media. I'm not going to really talk about it here, but I'm in the middle of a career change. I am still flying, but
Matt
I'm
works for NASA now.
Thank you, Devin. Yeah, I work for NASA. Not quite, but anyways,
just
I mean,
kidding. He's not that cool.
I'm making a career change. That, you know, it's going to come out later this year what I'm doing. I'm still in aviation. I'm still flying, but I'm going back into the style of flying I love that suits who I am as a pilot more than what I was doing. And I'll probably still do some stuff in the corporate world, but I mean, it's funny though, like you said, you were furloughed 3 times. I've flown corporate airplanes that keep selling underneath. I've gone through so many sales of aircraft where you just lose your job one day because the owner sells the airplane and you're like, you know, now what? And it's funny how long it kind of takes us to like for that switch to click in our head. Like, hey, like, why am I doing this? Like, there's other jobs that are steadier, that are fun, that are exciting, that I have the talent and I have the connections to go do. Why am I just not doing that today?
Sure. You know? Yeah. Oh, no, absolutely.
It's funny how long it took me 12 years to kind of feel. I mean, the job that I have now that I'm going into, I've been trying to get into for 12 years. It's not an easy industry to get into, which I learned. But once you kind of figure out how to go there, you're like, no, that's where I'm going with my career. Like that's the way I'm going. And that's kind of cool that you've taken that aircraft sales line. Because that what you are, in my view of aviation, where kids growing up, like there was a lot of dealers. I mean, every airport had a Beechcraft dealer, a Cessna dealer. Like, you could go anywhere and see airplanes, but it's kind of a dying breed now. Like, there's just not aircraft dealers anymore. So seeing you and you flourishing in California is really unique to see that style of aviation, that line of work still kind of exist.
Sure, and we're typically the Cub Crafters dealer network. We're all sort of individuals that are out there promoting the product and getting demo flights and supporting these communities and helping the communities in our area grow and sort of working on that synergy, working with the factory and our customer groups to keep the product line growing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's what counts. And it's hopefully we could figure out a way to do more stuff and more interactive to have some fun with the Cub stuff and outside of other facets. But, you know, like I fully enjoy letting you let me bring Devin up and let you get in the aircraft. You've always been really good about me with me. Anytime I wanted to show people the aircraft, or you're like, bring them up. You know, I have time today. Let's go put them in the airplane. Sure. Let's show them what it's all about. And that's something that I've always like really admired about you. Like you always take people at face value and you're like, hey, like I'm here because I have something really fun I want to share it, and maybe we can get you into this somehow.
Absolutely.
And that's like kind of the unique style. And that was the coolest thing, watching him taxi back into the hangar the other day and just smiling ear to ear. Like, there's nothing like that, you know? Yeah. So We definitely want to keep working more with you, kind of figure out some more stuff. And, you know, maybe you could set us up with something at Cub Crafters where we go tour the factory on something one day and we'll go up there.
That'd be really cool.
We could show him more the manufacturing side of things, because that's always kind of fun. So maybe we could work something out where we go up to Yakima this year and do something with an owner or board member, or maybe just with you up there.
Sure.
You go tour around. Let's go have some fun.
Or they can just let us roam the thing for free, you know, just by ourselves.
What I should do is have you guys do one of the FX program builds. I think that'd be pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. Watch us try and struggle.
I'll do it. I think it'd be awesome.
I'll do it.
Yeah, no, I think it'd be really cool.
Matt, did you see Bolt AC? I'm looking for AC. I mean, it looks pretty important.
I don't think it's important.
Devin's just going to hold a wing, just going, what's this? Does anyone know what this goes to? Let's do it. Yeah, let's, if we could figure out a way to do that, I'm 100% in. We'll go up there for a couple days. The fun part, we've said it on every other podcast, we love changing our environment. This one, we kind of all went dress code. We went black and white today. This was really fun. But we like being able to take it to different environments, and that's something that we find unique with this whole thing, and being able to give our viewers something new and just not a studio in our backdrop, which is fun, but it's cool that we can get out in the field and show some stuff. So that's something we can work on. But yeah, I mean, I really appreciate you taking time out of your day.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Of course. Multiple days now. Let's just keep coming back and bothering you. This isn't a one-time day.
Hey, are you busy later?
See you guys next Thursday.
Yeah, what do you guys got? What do you got going on next Wednesday? Yeah. Thank you for doing the vlog. We have a vlog coming, flying with Ben. Maybe we'll get one with
it's
me.
It's basically just my ugly mug smiling the whole time, and then a couple cool shots of him flying.
Yeah, so maybe we'll get one with Ben and I up in the airplane. We'll talk about it. Maybe we'll go put me back up there and see what I can still do. In the meantime, stay tuned. Where can we find you, Ben? At Cal Cubs on Instagram. Yep. How can we find you?
CaliforniaCubs.com is the website, and then Instagram, Facebook as well. We have a Cal Cubs. I think it's Cal_Cubs on there. And yeah, hit me up anytime.
He's like, yeah, you know, if you need a plane, just let me know.
I'm your guy.
I'm your guy.
So follow Ben. You're on YouTube still?
Yeah, I haven't done much YouTube stuff, but like to get back into it.
Yeah, there's videos of him flying aerobatics on his YouTube channel, the old 1-8 Zulu Quebec where it first started. You can find those videos out there still. You can see where he lands on the beach. If you ever have legality, wondering how the legality of how we operate, that's a whole podcast we can get into another day. But everything we do is legal.
Yep.
Everything we do is legal. We're not breaking the law when we're going out and doing this stuff. We are very understandable of what the laws in our airspace is, what we're allowed to do, and how we're able to operate in the airspace we do. So if you guys ever see something that we're doing inside the low-level flying, please talk to us. Email us. We're more than happy to tell you like what we're doing is absolutely legal. And this is fun.
Yeah.
So if you guys ever get a chance to get up in the Bush airplanes, go check them out. And I mean, if you guys are in the market, there might be someone out here in the market looking for a Cub. Contact Ben. He will get you lined up.
He's your guy.
He's one of the best guys out there. So Ben, we appreciate you. Thank you. And
thank you for joining us.
We'll be in touch. Thanks, bud.
Of course.
All right. Have a good one, guys.